Okay, let's get started. The next presentation will be by David Johnson, Hardwood Security Architect at Intel Corporation, and he'll be talking about improved approaches to online health testing in SP800-90 RNGs.
Hi, good afternoon. So for those of you who don't know, my job for the past 5 or 6 years has been involved designing random number generators full time, so this is something I think about quite a lot. I'm not trying to sell you anything, except a couple of ideas. So, when we think about a random number generator, there are two basic models, and you can take this and split them up many ways or embed RNGs and RNGs, and there are diagrams like that in SP800-90. But we end up with two basic types, and they're differentiated not necessarily by the technology or the structure, but the service they offer at the other end. And the service they offer, if you have a DRBG type output, as per CTR DRBG or one of the options in SP800-90A, the guarantee you're getting at the far end is a computational bound on the adversary trying to predict outputs or previous outputs or future outputs from currently visible values. Now, that's good enough for cryptography, but it comes with some challenges in using it correctly, and I'll get to that. The guarantee of an output of an extractor, if you meet its input requirements, is a certain amount of min entropy, and with a certain amount of min entropy, you are providing a more flexible type of random number. You can concatenate those things together to make bigger keys safely. If you concatenate order 2 to the 128 prediction resistance type number coming out of a DRBG, and I take two of them, two 128-bit values, and plug them together, my problem becomes order 2 to the 128 plus order 2 to the 128, which is order 2 to the 129, which is probably not what you intended. So, and in fact, these two models reflect the read rand and read seed instructions in Intel CPUs, the one on the bottom being read seed. It's a lot slower because it's as fast as the entropy source, not the DRBG, but cryptographically it's harder to shoot yourself in the foot. But when you build one of these things, you have to comply with the spec, and it requires you to do some testing. And there's a chicken and egg thing here where there's an entropy source which you can think of as a non-deterministic circuit. Sometimes it's thought of as an analog circuit. At Intel, we like metastable entropy sources where everything's digital, but the analog properties of latches are what's being exploited. But that helps with manufacturability. But the other part of it is all deterministic. It's digital logic. I don't do software implementations of these things, so it's all digital logic in my world. And the simple observation is the online health test, the stuff that does the statistical testing of the entropy source, is in the deterministic logic. So you need to test that stuff first with your known answer tests, and then you can go on to test the entropy source. So we find, you know, there's two phases. First you do the known answer testing, test all your digital logic. And an interesting thing you see when you're looking at that and reading the spec is I need to test my digital logic. Yet when your business is making chips, you will find that the logic integrity testing requirements of a company that manufactures digital logic on chips is far more developed than anything in SP800-90. We know how to test digital logic, and if you were to take our standard LBIST mechanisms, you would come up with something which is much better developed at telling you, yes, this digital logic does what it claims to do. And so you end up with a situation of then trying to crowbar that back into the spec, which is a minor gripe. You can do it, but the spec could say a lot less about known answer testing because it needs to just appeal to the ability that we all have to test the integrity of logic. It's not hard. All right, so let's move on. So one of the things we find in this online testing is they give you a couple of tests to choose from. There's the adaptive proportion test and the RCT. And both of those have a couple of nasty properties. They are, in one sense, they claim to be looking for a fault, but you can consider them a way of distinguishing a random sequence from a non-random sequence, and focusing on data which might be a stuck-at fault versus data which might be random. And when you think about statistically testing random data, there's a basic principle. You can't test for random. This is not a thing you can do. In any truly random sequence, all values are equally likely. So the probability of getting a zero is the same as the probability of getting a randomish looking thing, is the probability of getting AAA, is the probability of getting FFF. These are equally probable, but in large volume, unlikely. So some patterns are characteristic of a broken state, but not in and of themselves a guarantee of a broken state. On the patterns characteristic of a broken state might be something with high serial correlation or high bias. Those would be two common broken states of entropy sources. I've known many broken entropy sources in my life, and that is characteristic of the failure mode of most of them. Either nothing comes out, or there's some feedback mechanism which is too strong or too weak or should be there but is broken, and it goes into an oscillating state or a stuck state. So what we can test for is the failure modes of the RNG. And the right thing to do when you of the entropy source, I mean, the right thing to do with an entropy source is think about those failure modes in a systematic way. Do a single point of failure analysis, do a double point of failure analysis. And you can go through and establish everything, every broken characteristic over an SPOF and DPOF analysis. And you will find, if you're lucky, it's only those things. It's only high serial correlation and it's only high bias. If you're not lucky, there'll be some really nasty things where it goes through multiple states. And if you do, maybe you want to think about redesigning your entropy source, so that it's more easily testable. But the right thing to do in a test is to test for the failure modes, and we can do that. Now, it becomes difficult if you've got, say, a ring oscillator with with 10 ring oscillators of relatively prime length. You might have many thousands of transistors in that circuit, and a double point of failure analysis is going to be, say, 10,000 times 10,000, which is a big number of tests to fail. The entropy source we currently have, our current design, which is being rolled out at the moment in our products, we call it ES2. We have ES1, which used to be called the entropy source. It became ES1 when we have ES2. But it's one of its characteristics is it has 70 transistors. And this is a nice property because the DPOF analysis is 70 times 70, which is, 35, you know. Yes, something like that. Yeah, 5,000 cases. I mean, you can do that. That's a tractable solution to just go through, you know, set a job running for a week, and you'll come back with all the failure cases. And so you can do a rigorous analysis saying what do the failure cases look like, and then do tests that find those cases. So here's the one. So my assertion is you can test for broken maybe. These patterns look like characteristics of failures, but maybe they're not. Maybe they're randomly occurring. And here's what we do. Now this is based on an entropy source that is it's a metastable latch with a feedback loop. Both entropy sources work this way that we have. And it starts producing ones or zeros. And if it's producing too many ones, we feed it. Each time it produces a one, we push it in the direction of producing more zeros, and vice versa, so it stays in the middle of its metastable region. Logically, that introduces some serial correlation. If the last value is a zero, you're more likely to produce a one. But you'd like that to be a small effect. But it's never zero. And when you look at the different entropy source designs, there's almost a... ones that you can build a billion of and they don't break, they are a circuit with some electrical feedback that keeps it working in a mode that's stable and oscillating or whatever it needs to do. So serial correlation tends to be the primary error mode that you see when it gets too great. I can point to an entropy source I reviewed, it wasn't my design, where what had happened, it had been used in a... It was an IP, it was bought, it was used in one, it worked in some chip. Sometime it was put in a new chip and overclocked massively. They could synthesize the logic to this high frequency, but they were sampling a a ring oscillator, and they went from undersampling it to oversampling it, and then got high serial correlation as a result, and that's easily detected. So here's what we do. We have essentially a sliding window. We have a shift register. The data comes in serially, and you just look at one of those bits and say, is it a 1, and you count that, or is it a 0, 1, and you count that. So we've got these different length strings, and there are 16 plus 8 plus 4 plus 2 plus 1, you know, possible things to look for. But we're looking for these things which are characteristic of, so 1001 is characteristic of longer strings rather than shorter strings. So if you think of high serial, negative serial correlation, there's going to be more transitions. If you're thinking of low serial correlation, positive serial correlation, you're thinking of long strings of ones or long strings of zeros. But if there's more of one, there's less of the other. And so you don't really need to test both halves. So what we do is we run these tests, we match these frequencies, match these patterns, we count them, we do a bunch of modeling and say, well, in random data that's characteristic of our entropy source, including its correlative properties, including its deviations that we expect, we can model what the bounds would be and set those bounds given a particular false positive rate. And we'd like that false positive rate to be quite high, so I'll get to why. But one of the things that SP800-90 says, and I think, finish with this first. An observation of this is it's really cheap. It's six comparators, six counters, and a shift register. And what this is doing is counting over 256-bit samples. So each 256-bit sample, if any of those counts is outside the bound, we tag it as unhealthy. If they're all inbound, we tag it as healthy. And there's some power associated with measuring all these things at the same time on the same data. And you can do the analysis and show that it rejects all repeated sequences up to 6 bits in length. You could make it more rigorous by changing the bounds or adding more values, but that seems to be enough. So SP800-90 says, when a failure is detected in an RBG component and reported to the RBG as a whole, it shall enter an error state. Okay, so we don't really want to have false positives that force us into an error state. And these tests are run continuously. So we get this problem, there's this trade-off. If we have a lower false positive rate, that implies a higher false negative rate. The spec explicitly asks us to have a low false positive rate so the thing doesn't fail, because the effect of a false positive is to report an error which causes us to go in an error state. And it gives an example in SP800-90B of, I think the RCT test claims to be false positive rate of 2 to the minus 30. That's actually not that great. Our random number generator, the fastest one we do is 2.5 gigabytes a second. You run through 2 to the minus 30 samples quite quickly, and it wouldn't be good to be entering into an error state every few seconds. So actually what we want is a high false positive rate, but a system that's tolerant of high false positive rates. Because what you're doing is being suspicious of the data. You're not saying this is broken because you failed this little statistical test. You want to look at the history of the statistical test and make good decisions about whether the thing is really broken or not. This is where entropy pools come in. This is what we do. But I think as a general principle, this is a good way of meeting testing requirements and having timely responses to failure. And that's something you don't find with the RCT test or the adaptive proportion test. It's they don't give you a timely response. You've got to buffer up some data, run the test over it to get reasonable confidence, and then you can use the data. And that's not great, especially if you have to put memories in your design, because side channel problem, memories are the worst thing you can put in your design. Margaret Salter, she works at the NSA, and in the car park of the NSA Museum, she said, well, basic principle, never throw away entropy. I thought, well, that's a nice principle. And one way of realizing this, if we're using the CBC MAC extractor that's in SP800-90B, I'm actually guilty of lobbying to get this put in the spec, so if you don't like that test, blame me, but it's what we do in Intel chips. And what we do is take the last output, the last conditioned seed value, and we MAC it, and we add the extra entropy in the raw data from the entropy source to make a value. So what we want to do is integrate the health tagging into this feedback loop where what's in the entropy pool is fed back into the extractor along with new entropy source data. And so the simple requirement is Xi to Xi plus R, the samples we're putting in this case, it's a little complicated because AES has a 128-bit block size, which I don't like, but this means, and the for a CTR DIBG, you need a 256-bit seed, so you got to do it twice, and it's messy. But this is a simple view. Xi to Xi plus R are samples from the entropy source, 256 bits each, and that contains at least the required number of healthy samples, which is typically 3 in Intel. So we're taking 756 bits of data and crunching it down to 256 bits of data using CBC MAC, plus the last output, plus critically any other unhealthy samples that came along. The only difference is we don't count it. So I might get Xi, it turns out to be a healthy sample, great, and I set my counter to 1, and I get the next sample, and that's unhealthy, so I don't increase my counter, get the next sample, next two samples, they're healthy and healthy. I've now sampled over 1,024 bits of entropy, and you can think about this. What happens if the quality of the entropy drops? If somebody starts firing an EM probe at your entropy source, and if somebody's doing that, you probably want to shoo them away, but... if that's happening and something's happening that's reducing the quality of the entropy from the entropy source, what will happen is the rate of unhealthy samples will go up, so the amount of entropy you end up mixing into each seed goes up in proportion up until you get to the point where you say enough is enough, I've got too high an error rate. Let's look at what actually happens when you do something like this. And what we actually do for the long-term error response is we look at the history of the last 256 samples. So each of these H or a U is healthy or unhealthy over 256 bits measured from the entropy source. And I couldn't fit 256 horizontally, so I pretended it's a smaller field. But we've got M samples and N healthy ones, so we call it the N of M counter. And you might get this sequence like this where... expected data that we get from the entropy source. If we have a marginal entropy source, we might find that those unhealthy samples increase, and we just have a simple split down the middle. If it's less than 50% healthy to unhealthy, we declare the system to be broken, and we raise an error, and you know, bad things happen. And the idea is that never happens. This is a basic requirement. So, but we detect it when it does. The other way of looking at this is am I going from a transition to from not broken to broken? So a transistor pops, or somebody fires a laser at a transistor, or whatever. So you get this pattern characteristic of healthy data where there's the occasional false positive, and then you go to, it's unhealthy. It's got a stuck at, it's got something, everything's failing. You'd like to have an instantaneous response to that event. And so that's exactly what happens. Instantaneous response to a break, which responds by blocking the flow of seeds, and now your DRBG, if that's what you're doing, is going to produce no more, is not going to produce any more data after needing a seed when you've reached your reseed counter limit. Now, the reseed counter limit is 2 to the 40 in the spec, I think, but ours is 511. We'd never reach that given the seed rate. Our seed rate is about 1 million a second, so you don't get very far before you get another seed. So why make the counter bigger? So you've got this fairly simple mechanism by including a tagging in the loop, using that to decide how much entropy you extract or how much entropy you put into the extractor, that gives you an adaptive response to a degradation scenario and an instant response to a failure scenario. And this is what we want out of a test, a high false positive rate, so we have a low false negative rate, so we're not letting bad stuff through, and the right kind of temporal response to entropy source failure. So that seems like a neat thing, and we like that. Now, you might be of a cryptographic mind, and you say, hang on a minute, CBCing over varying data isn't very good, because I've read Evgeny Dodis's paper, and it dings you for putting more data in. If you've got fairly concentrated data, it's good, but the result gets worse and worse as you work over larger fields. That's a counterintuitive result, but it's the bounds he produced. But actually, it's not true, and there's a paper, 7 in the references, by Seth Tereshmina, who proved that it's okay. He extended Dodis's results. So we didn't know that when we created the circuit. It was a hand-wavy argument, but we didn't hire him either. And he went to Qualcomm. It's a great shame. But anyway. okay, so I think I've just made this argument. What makes pool feedback good? We get... We have a product that does 768 down to 256, and it reseeds very frequently. And you can also think of the DRBG pool being a pool. So we saturate fairly quickly. We saturate within microseconds of turning on the power. So if you've got Linux and you're using readRAND, you get early boot entropy, which seems to be a popular problem to talk about. If the entropy source breaks, you get no more... we get an instant response in terms of producing no more seeds, and we get an error response after 128 samples goes through, which is it's not slow. It's a 2.5 gigabit per second entropy source, so it's 5 gig on Xeons. So anyway, so let's move on to what's wrong with SP 800-90C. How much time do I have? Okay, all right. About halfway through, okay. There's a part of the of SP100-90C which it describes the XOR construction and the oversampling construction. It says if you're taking the extractor output, so going back to the start, this bottom model, that's the nice one. It's not as fast, but it's the better one from a security point of view because people can't mess up in using the numbers. But they require that you put in a DRBG in the XOR case, and I think we can... we either have the XOR construction where we take an output from the DRBG and we take a seed and... XOR them together, and that is each value. So two things have happened now. We've actually halved the reseed rate, because you've still got one extractor and one entropy source, unless you put two in. And you know, in our implementation, it round robins. It gives one to the DRBG and one to the ENRBG for the XOR construction if you're loading both ports. Then the oversampling construction requires that you do reseeds in between each generate. So you're doing it that way. Now, if we look at an implementation which has an entropy source, an extractor, and both a DRBG output and an ENRBG output meeting SP800-90A and C, and B if the extractor matches as well, you've got these processes going on. Calling on the DRBG does a generate and then an update at the end of the length. And that's for a number of blocks of data, that's one AES per block plus another two AESs for the update and a CTR DRBG and something similar for hash DRBGs. For the ENRBG, you have to do a reseed, a generate, a reseed, so you're in between each generate, so you're pulling in these extra seeds, which are arriving more slowly than the output of the DRBG. The real addition of the DRBG is performance, and in the case of the ENRBG, it's some idea that it's making the thing more reliable, because if the entropy source fails, you fall back to the strength of the ENRBG and saying, oh, we're keeping a pool, and that'll save us. But we're testing for this. You're essentially saying we don't trust the tests, and we think the tests won't capture the data, maybe because we've set such a low false positive rate. and that just seems back to front. So the what happens to this then if I'm sharing this DRBG and I've got a system, I've got an Intel chip, I've got a read rand and a read seed instruction, and I'm using read rand because my crypto system is 2 to the 128 security. And if somebody comes along and starts doing ENRBG calls to read seed, we end up with blocking between the DRBG. So the DRBG can output at a high rate, the ENRBG can operate maybe 100 times slower, but now you've blocked, because you're using the AESs for reseeding frequently, which are blocking on the reseed. So you've slowed down your, when you're using both ports, you've slowed down to the speed of the slowest on both ports. And that's not ideal. For the XOR construction, I didn't draw this diagram properly. Okay, the XOR construction, you pretty much the same thing happens. You're taking a value from the extractor and you're XORing it without output of the DRBG. Let's skip that slide because it's wrong. So let's look at surface area in the context of this, the oversampling and XOR constructions we have in SP100-90C. This is what we call ES2 in Intel. This is our second entropy source, or our second metastable entropy source. We published a paper on this at ESS CERC in Austria. I was the lead author, but my colleague got to go to Austria, so I'm very bitter about that. But so we published this. It is a three entropy sources. They are substantially smaller than the previous one because they don't have any capacitive feedback. It's digital feedback, which is nice from various properties, which I won't go into. It's all in the paper. But with a bit of pre-extraction to reduce any correlation between them, there isn't any, but we just make sure. And we go on into what's called a Barakin-Pagliazzo-Wigderson extractor, and then into an output pool. The logic in this total is 800 gates. The area of the circuit is 1,000 square microns, and that's not an efficient layout. We could pack it in a bit harder. And the entropy sources each have 70 transistors. So, like I was saying, this admits a deep-off analysis where you can say, well, what are all the error states? What do they look like? That metric taker down the bottom is the test I described, which is in both the DRNG, the big one, and the CPUs, and this little one. And this is originally thought up for IoT solutions. But this thing's really small, and it produces 100 megahertz, 20 megabits a second. It's good enough for many applications. It doesn't do the 2.5 gigabytes a second for a network concentrator that we have in the Xeons, but it does it for most other requirements are fairly low. So. Look at this. If we have the, you can't see the pointer, that's a shame. All right. So we have the ES and extractor, which is what I just showed. Let me just go back and explain. This BIW extractor, its requirements are three independent sources, and it uses an 8-bit Galois field, and it computes A times B plus C, where A, B, and C are the three sources. And there's a nice proof from Barakin, Pagliazzo, and Wigderson that says that's a good extractor, and it is, and it relies on the independence of the sources. You compare that to the 30K gates for a solution using a 10-clock AES, that's quite a lot smaller. So we've got our entropy source and our extractor, and we've got a switch, and we've got a DRBG that it's switching the seeds between the DRBG and the ENRBG output, and the DRBG gives a value to the XOR, and you XOR the two together, and you get the ENRBG output. Well, let's look at the surface area. Let's say, in the best case, the DRBG is 30 times the area of the entropy source and the extractor. In the worst case, it's about, this 100K gates is no longer true. The highest DRBG gate count we have is 150K gates for the fastest DRNG, because we put more AES blocks in to run in parallel to go faster. And the smallest is 30K. That would be typical of what you find in Ivy Bridge. But from a reliability point of view, the failure rate in the field, I mean, if it fails in production, you don't see it. We throw it away. But if it fails in the field, that's what we don't want to happen, but it's also what we want to capture reliably. The probability of a failure, what's going to happen? Is it going to happen in the entropy source, or is it going to happen in the DRBG? Now, the probability of failure is a function of the the environment it is in over time, the aging, the ratio of the time that it was turned on. But critically, the other, one of the parameters is the surface area. All other things factored out, the error rate is in the field is proportional to the surface area, because we get essentially random transistor errors. And one of the reasons we get random transistor errors is individual transistors are rarely more likely to fail than other transistors, because we do a lot of analysis that do what's called aging analysis, and that makes sure that that's the case. So we've got a problem where now we've added something to try and ensure the thing is safer, but you've increased the chances of having an error in the deterministic logic, which could fail in ways which would actually break the output. We could solve this problem of the blocking between DRBGs and ENRBGs for oversampling by putting two DRBGs in to separate them, but oh no, now we are 40 to 100 times the failure rate because of the increased surface area. If we just took the ES extractor model we showed and used that, it's fast enough for applications, our reliability would actually be substantially better than an SP800-90 solution, which is putting in all this logic to provide a safety net which actually increases the error rate. That seems counterproductive. It would be sufficient to just have an entropy source and an extractor, providing we have good online tests saying this process is still working, and the way I described is a way of doing that by having an entry pool and adapting the amount of stuff you mix into the pool so that we know it's good, and then having a longer term response that says, now we've got the ratio of unhealthy to healthy has got too bad and we're going to declare an error, which you can do the math and say statistically this is because the thing's broken in some way, but it's by looking for errors you know exist. If you have an entropy source that is very serially correlated just in its nature and it's got maybe 50% entropy, that's fine. You know what to do from an extractor point of view. As long as you know the entropy, you can produce an extractor which deals with it. But the patterns you might look for, or the bounds on the patterns, would be different. It would match the behavior of the entropy source you have, rather than matching some model of what ideal entropy looks like, which is what the RCD and APT test in SP800-90B do. They give a bunch of numbers and tables based on their performance over good data and supposedly bad data, assuming bad data looks like stuckats. Where am I? 16. All right. So then we have FIPS 140-2. Now, we had problems with SP800-90A. There was a fourth random DRBG, and we didn't like that one very much. If you implement it in a FIPS context, not just an SP800-90 context, you end up with section 4.9.2, which, if each call to an RNG produces blocks of n bits, where n is greater than 15, so this could be applied over 16-bit output. Now, that's one of the Intel instructions, is a 16-bit output. You get 16, 32, or 64-bit dumped into your register. So the read rand to a 16-bit target register in Intel hits the worst case of this test. It's strange that it's a test, because it's a data-modifying test. What it does is, if your value equals the previous value, you flag it as an error. Now, it doesn't say what you do when you flag it as an error. This is local system error, it's not the RNG as a whole error, but the logical thing to do is to throw it away. If you're not doing anything with the flag, you're not doing the test. You're just going through the motions. So the logical thing to do is throw it away. It becomes trivially easy to distinguish data that's been run through this process from random. Get pure random data, run it through this process, and say a megabyte of data, I've got a 10-line Python script which can say, yes, this has been through that process. It's trivially distinguishable from random. This is not a property we want in a secure random number generator, and it's enough to break DSA. The other slightly more worrying thing is it creates these algebraic invariants. You know that in a sequence ABC, A doesn't equal B, B doesn't equal C, C doesn't equal D. If I was trying to do an algebraic attack, I think I'd find that very useful. Now, I don't know of an algebraic attack against, say, the CTR-DRBG, but I'm not the NSA. I'm not, you know, I'm not an intelligence agency of any country, but I might have people who knew how to do that. And it seems strange that this would be there. And what's worse about this is in FIPS, it applies to every DRBG. So if you're looking in SP800-90, looking for any other backdoors, you're looking in the wrong place. Look at FIPS and you'll find data changing processes on RNGs that shouldn't be there. And you'll find the reason Intel doesn't have FIPS certification for its RNG is for no other reason that we don't implement that, because we refuse to do it. Because we just won't. All right, so ISO 19790-2012, which might become FIPS 140-3, removed this test. And you might think, well, why did they do that? Well, you could have conspiracy theories, but the logical thing they did in ISO 19790 is actually define what happens when you go into an error state. They have some much more developed text than 140-2 does. So once you go to do that, then you look at this test, the 492 test, the CRNGT test, and say, oh, look, we're going to fail every 65,000 samples, and then we're going to have to do the procedure we just specified, and now the RNG won't work. Our RNG would fail in a few microseconds if you did this. And so they took out the test, because it was obviously stupid in the context of a system where you've actually defined what you're doing with the error state coming out of this test. So we've got that problem, and then we've got, still, we can't have resource-constrained devices which are FIPS compliant because of the DRBG requirement, which makes it 20 times or 30 times bigger. We don't like that. So I think I've left lots of time for questions. Right. So in summary, pool structures that use health tagging to allow appropriate responses to entropy source failure and this different but timely response to degradation in terms of, so timely, well, that's back to front, a timely response to failure and a adaptive conditioning response to degradation is what you want, and you can do that very easily without having tests that consume a lot of memory, without having things like the APT, which you're forced into this trade-off between entropy loss. I wrote it down. Where is it? So the entropy loss in the adaptive proportion test gets better as you put more memory in. So if you put like 64K of memory in, you get a 6% entropy loss. If you do the minimum case, you get a 67% entropy loss. So you're just throwing away data before you've got started, which violates what, you know, the head of cryptography at the NSA said in the car park of the NSA museum, which is never throw away entropy. Oh, we've got tests which throw away entropy. Let's not do that. And FIPS 140-2 makes it worse by reducing the security of the RNG output. It specifies to do that on the output. Well, it depends how you read it, but they say, oh, you need to provide it on the entropy source output and the RNG output, maybe. But it's ambiguous, and I've seen people interpret it both ways. But if you apply it on the output, you're hosed because you've got something distinguishable from random. And here's a list of the references. So questions. That was my thesis on what's wrong with SP800-90 testing, and we can do it better and more cheaply.
I do have a question.
Kemp?
That relates to the use of the pools.
Yes. Yes. Yes, well, in fact, that's what we do. So we've got this 256 buffer of the history of healthy and unhealthy samples, and it's literally a delay line, and you poke one in one end and another pops out the other, and it shifts along, and there's a counter that if it sees a one go in, it increments, and if it sees a one come out the other end, it decrements, so it keeps a running total. And that's what we call the health count. It's the ratio, is how many healthy samples were in the last 256. If it drops below 50%, we essentially declare we don't trust any samples now, whether they're healthy or not, and we require the history to go back up above, maybe it's 75. There's some hysteresis in there because we don't want it to oscillate at the at that point. So yes, we do that. I've done this experiment. I've gone in with the chips where we haven't fused all the protections in, and I can break the entropy source and by changing some physical parameters which are there to break it, and then watch it stop and block at the output, and then unbreak it and watch it start up again. And those, but you can see the error state. It's there in the status register. You might say, well, why didn't I get a value? I should always get a value because this thing's faster than the bus. And you can read the status and find out what happened. Hope that answers your question. Yeah, so that's an interesting, I can rant all day about the Linux random service, but in this case, the discussions, I was involved in those discussions, they basically didn't trust that there was any entropy in what was coming from read-rand. Now that's almost rational in the sense that it's a DRBG output. In the worst case, you're getting 128 bits of entropy in 511 outputs. But you actually can't pull that fast. It's closer to 1 in 22. So you could, we actually give instructions in the software reference manual for read-rand and read-seed to say, if you're trying to use read-rand to get entropy, take so much data and mac it together down to 128, and you'll get back the entropy that went into it. But it has to be over a large enough range or sampled with gaps in between, which you need some privilege to block everybody else out so they're not also reading from it at the same time, which a kernel can do. So maybe at boot time on a kernel, you could do that and get a value that's in full entropy. But the point was, it wasn't designed like that. Read seed was designed to give you a full entropy value. So they seed the pool with it, and that's good. That means that actually fixes dev u random from the point of view you've got a pool which has got 4,000 bits of random numbers which people aren't going to be able to predict. And the reason for the pool being that big, I've talked with Ted Cho about this, the real reason for that being that big is because they know there are people who are going to try and make 256-bit keys and 512-bit keys, symmetric keys, and out of this. And they just picked a number that was bigger than the worst case stupid PRNG that somebody was going to seed with it. Whereas read-rand, if you seeded your 256-bit security DRBG from read-rand, you'd be doing the wrong thing because it's 128-bit, pertinent to the LDOS, your presentation earlier. Now this leads to problems in Linux in many configurations. The one is you might be in a computer that has, say it's an Intel CPU and it has read-rand and read-seed, and you boot up and you've got an instant supply of entropy at 800 megabytes a second to 2.5 gigabytes a second, depending on which chip you buy. That should translate into DevRandom working. But if there are no other sources of entropy, maybe you're in a VM, you've got quantized interrupt timing, there is no entropy coming in. This is a problem. Read-rand and read-seed are the only sources which are designed to punch through the VM. That was one of the problems that we were trying to solve. And then the kernel sits there in a high entropy situation because it's mixed it in, but it's blocking because it thinks it's in a low entropy situation. And you get into a situation, as in the mining your P's and Q's paper, where you had kernels that were not blocking in a low entropy situation. So you've got this inverted behavior which has led to published failures of crypto systems. The right thing to do would be to be knowledgeable about when you're in a high and low entropy situation correctly and block appropriately. And now you told me that that's been fixed earlier in some ways, and I sincerely hope it is, and I'm going to go back and look at what changed in the most recent updates. Oh, you're talking about it. Excellent. Okay. Okay.
And then secondly, I was also on the receiving end of that talk because I was also pushing to on the kernel side to get it out again.
Yeah.
Because it used to be in there between the 15 and 16.
That's right, with Peter Anvin's submissions.
Problem that
locally in a library, right. So my opinion of the kernel's job in this is to do the mixing. That's what it brings to the party. We are one source. You might have other sources. And it's absolutely the correct thing to do, to mix those sources, because I may be the only person in the world who actually knows why this thing doesn't have back doors, because I've looked at it every other way. But nobody in the world else in the world has this. And I don't know if anybody else's source is backdoored. So the right thing to do is to mix these things together. Most people don't know if anybody's sources are backdoored or not, because they're not delved into the design. So you mix them together. Now, I would say if that's the kernel's job, it's its job to do the right thing, which is to not let one dominate. So it should maybe get 256 bits of entropy from read-rand. It should get 256 bits of entropy from somewhere else. It doesn't have to get more. It just needs to get enough to seed the pools well, and then maybe do that periodically, because that's good as well, but keep pools and don't use LFSRs as extractors on that, please. Just do something cryptographic. Well, it's in the same block of logic. We have one DRBG and
I suggest to my clients who are interested in DRM, who has issues where it's early immediate entropy, to alter and rewrite RAND and see where it is mixed in RDRAM command output and whatever entropy estimate rate they feel positive about. Mm-hmm.
So one of the problems in Linux is it only has integer entropy estimates, unless that's changed.